Supporting WHYY, the Rutgers Camden MBA degree allows for specializations in critical areas such as finance, international business, marketing, entrepreneurship, and others. Evening and Saturday classes are held at the Rutgers Camden campus and Camden County College. An information session is on Tuesday, June 23rd at 6 p.m. at Camden County College in Cherry Hill. Details at mba.rutgers.edu or 856-225-6452. Rutgers School of Business, Camden. Expect more. Be more.
Graduation exams are rolling toward us in Pennsylvania, though it seems the legislature might be letting up on the gas a bit. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. In Pennsylvania, passing the Keystone exams will be required to don a cap and gown, starting with the class of 2017. But as WHYY's Laura Benshoff reports, there's growing momentum to rethink the tests before they start to count.
Even though the Keystones won't keep anyone from graduating this year, Senator Lloyd Smucker of Lancaster says many students are already experiencing negative consequences.
Next year, students that may have plan to go to career and technology centers. Some are being held back for remediation classes. That's certainly not a consequence that we would like.
So Smucker's proposed a bill to postpone the Keystones becoming a requirement to graduate until 2019. The Senate's Education Committee unanimously passed his bill this week. Smucker says the delay isn't just about creating a longer runway.
But it is secondly about improving the process as well.
That could mean giving students the option to pass other tests, like the NOCTI, a national test for career and technical classes, or the SAT instead. While Governor Tom Wolf isn't backing Smucker's bill, he says he does support a delay.
As a means to the end of having a rational conversation on accountability overall.
A recent report by the nonprofit Research for Action found students in the poorest counties typically performed worst on the exams. Schools also don't receive any additional funds to pay for the remediation many need to pass. For WHYY, I'm Laura Benchoff.
Last year, Philadelphia native Alice Goffman published On the Run, Fugitive Life in an American City, to great acclaim. The New York Review of Books predicted it would become a classic. It chronicled 6 years that Goffman spent living with low-income black men in West Philadelphia and their interactions with police. But now she's defending accusations that she embellished some of the accounts and even fabricated stories, as WHYY's Bobby Allen explains.
It might be hard for Goffman to even fact-check herself, because when she finished her research, she shredded her notebooks and tossed her hard drive. She says it's so the field notes on her subjects, who were shielded with fake names, couldn't be subpoenaed. Since the book came out, she did a hugely popular TED Talk, went on a speaking tour, and is even discussing a movie deal. But recently, somebody posted a 60-page anonymous takedown of the book, alleging big factual holes. It got people talking and placed new scrutiny on her research methods. Goffman, who is white and grew up in Center City, says some skeptics might be motivated to attack her because they feel uncomfortable with the reality in some neighborhoods.
Shocking and upsetting to many, many Americans. And I think that first reaction that people have to these reports, to my book, is this must not be happening.
Northwestern University law professor Stephen Lou Bay published an extensive critique in which he asserted that Goffman could have even at one point been prosecuted for a felony for aiding a planned revenge killing. In a scene in her book, Goffman waits in an idling car for a friend from the neighborhood who's ready to ambush someone with a loaded gun. No one got killed, but still, Lou Bay says, that, quote, constituted conspiracy to commit murder under Pennsylvania law. In response, Goffman says talk of retribution was just that, talk, and information not included in the book would have cleared her. Is she surprised by the new scrutiny? Perhaps, she says, but maybe it'll keep a public discourse going about policing in low-income neighborhoods, because learning about that is why she wrote the book to begin with. For WHYY News, I'm Bobby Allen.
Hear the name Hershey, and chocolate likely comes to mind, as well as the Hershey Medical Center, Hershey, PA, Hershey Park, and then perhaps the Milton Hershey School for Poor Children. The school and the children it's entrusted to serve is the topic of Philadelphia Inquirer business writer and author Bob Fernandez. His book is entitled The Chocolate Trust, Deception, Indenture, and Secrets at the $12 billion Milton Hershey School. Bob, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thank you, Dave.
It's a historical account, in a sense, and we learned that it was in the first decade of the 20th century that Milton Hershey and his wife Kitty were inspired by Stephen Girard, who back in 1833, established Girard College here in Philadelphia as a boarding school for poor fatherless boys. So why don't you take us back to the 1909 deed establishing the Hershey Trust Company's role?
He was a chocolate retailer here in Philadelphia before he became a manufacturer out in Hershey. And so when he got wealthy enough, he basically just copied Girard's model, including limiting the school to fatherless white boys. Stephen Girard had indentured the boys. Milton Hershey indentured the boys. And, you know, different, though, from Girard, Milton had this big business empire out in Hershey. He had 10,000 acres of land, much of it dairy farms. Then he was building what would become the largest chocolate factory in the world. And he housed the boys, the orphan boys, on those farms as teenagers, and they worked his farms when they weren't in school.
And so in addition to bringing farmers and laborers, expand on this notion of indentured servitude.
He indentured the boys, which were basically labor contracts between the boy's mother and the school. Pennsylvania was one of several states at that time that allowed charity case children to be indentured to farmers or corporations or other groups so that they could basically work off the cost of their care. And he also said that he indentured them because he wanted to have sort of total control of the boys and their upbringing, and that he didn't want the families to interfere with him. I think Milton was a charitable man, but I think first and foremost he was a businessman. These mothers were economically powerless as it was, and by forcing them to sign an indenture was taking even more economic power away from them. The last generation of Milton's leaders had retired in the late 50s. And a new generation took over. And I think that there was the idea that they didn't really like the thought of Hershey being like a trade school town or a town where poor boys lived. They had a sort of a bigger, more expansive view of the town. They wanted to sort of upgrade it. But at the same time, they knew the trust was throwing off all these assets that had to be spent. Well, they were either going to be spent on poor boys, as the trust told them, or they would have to find a new mission. And they tried to find a new mission, and that was to break apart the trust. I call it loot it in my book, and divert what was then $50 million, a hefty amount of the surplus, into the Hershey Medical Center. They secretly negotiated with the state attorney general. The governor was part of it, and the local orphans court to divert this money. They never held a public hearing on it. They never asked for public input as to say, hey, do you think we could care for more poor kids in Hershey? They just decided they couldn't, and they diverted the money.
Kathleen Kane campaigned on being a Harrisburg outsider who would take on the system, but you find fault with her for dropping the ball as well.
She was elected at a time where the investigation into this luxury golf course that the trust had purchased was far along. And I don't think anybody looking at that purchase would say that was a reasonable way to spend money that should go to poor children. It was appraised at $3 to $4 million as a golf course. It wasn't even finished. They bought it for $12 million. One of the part owners was the Hershey Chocolate CEO. There were these politically connected lawyers and doctors who owned it. So they paid two or three times the appraised value. And then they proceeded to build a $5 million clubhouse, a golf clubhouse on it, to create another high-end fancy golf course out there. And that was all done with school money. That investigation had been going on for 2 years when Kathleen came into office, and that investigation also looked into compensation on the boards. You have board members were making $100,000 minimum, some of them making $500,000. When they went to board meetings, they have first-rate lodgings. And well, she settled that case within just a couple months, or a few months of taking office. She just seemed to want to get it done. And her reforms were very similar to what had been discussed 20 years earlier that hadn't worked then. So her reforms did not meaningfully change the institution.
Bob Fernandez, thanks so much for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thank you, Dave.
Philadelphia Inquirer business writer Bob Fernandez, author of the new book entitled The Chocolate Trust, Deception, Indenture, and Secrets at the $12 billion Milton Hershey School. You can hear more of our conversation at newsworks.org. Turning to this evening's headlines, a U.S. appeals court knocks back an effort to curb the use of federal public defenders in state death penalty appeals in Pennsylvania. The court says the Pennsylvania Supreme Court has no oversight of the Federal Community Defender Organization. A Franklinville, New Jersey man pleads guilty to stealing more than $650,000 by sending invoices to schools across the country for math and language books that didn't exist. Robert Armstrong pleaded guilty to one count of mail fraud today in federal court in Camden. Atlantic City's eight casinos saw their revenue go up by more than 5% in May compared with a year ago. The casinos won just over $208 million from gamblers last month. The numbers were aided by $12.5 million in internet gambling winnings, and that's an increase of more than 19% over May 2014. The Delaware Division of Motor Vehicles announces an agreement between state officials and Uber, allowing the smartphone-powered private car service to operate in the state under new regulations. 91 degrees, partly cloudy skies on Independence Mall. It's 6:17. You're listening to Newsworks Tonight on WHYY. Partly cloudy this evening. There's a chance of a stray shower overnight, low 76 degrees. Tomorrow, partly sunny to start. Clouding up with a 50% chance of late-day showers or storms, Saturday's high 90. Sunday, plenty of sunshine, high 86 degrees. Monday, partly sunny, high again in the mid-80s. And ahead to Tuesday, intervals of sun and clouds, a 40% chance of precipitation, high near 90. Still ahead, this Sunday is Flag Day, the day the American flag was adopted in 1777. Does the legend of Betsy Ross hold true after all this time?
We present all the evidence we have, and we let the visitors form their own opinion whether or not they think that she did it. We say, here's what we know. Now, what do you think?
NewsWorks Tonight embraces the colors crimson, white, and indigo on WHYY.
The Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts supports WHYY. PAFA has an array of art classes and programs for all ages and skill levels this summer, including day camps for kids, pre-college programs for teens, and classes and workshops for adults in drawing, painting, sculpture, printmaking, and more. Workshops include a master class in June with classical realist artist and author Juliette Aristides. Registration now underway for summer classes. For more information, pafa.org/community education.
We are so close. I'm Marty Moscoen. For over a week now, we've been working towards a generous challenge presented by an anonymous donor in memory of Dr. Hubert J.P. Schumacher. We need to raise 1,000 pledges by June 15th to lock in a gift of $25,000. And we're over halfway there. Please visit WHYY.org to make your pledge of support at this critical time as WHYY nears the end of our fiscal year.
Fox Chase Cancer Center supports WHYY. Fox Chase was recognized and highlighted among Philadelphia hospitals for safety and surgical outcomes based on a nationwide study. Surgeons at Fox Chase are fellowship trained with up to 4 years of additional training on the complex techniques of cancer surgery. Part of Temple Health, Fox Chase is committed to patient safety, world-class care, and the best outcomes, and now offers next business day appointments. Learn more at 888-FOX-CHASE or foxchase.org.
Welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. This Sunday, June 14th, is Flag Day. It commemorates when Congress adopted the American flag in 1777. In Philadelphia, this is celebrated heartily at the Betsy Ross House. Reporter Ryan Noyes explores how the legend of Betsy Ross has changed dramatically over the past few years.
Waiting their turn to go inside the Betsy Ross House in Old City, Philadelphia, these fifth graders from Alexandria, Virginia, are eager to talk about the house's namesake.
Betsy Ross created it.
Created what?
The first flag.
The American
Betsy
flag.
Ross created the American flag.
Inside, however, they are hearing something rather different from the Betsy Ross reenactor.
Now, it was not I that did design that flag for General Washington.
For many years, the story was that Betsy Ross designed and stitched the first American flag and gave it to George Washington, and he approved it and became our country's flag. But that's not what we believe, and that's not the story we tell here any longer.
Lisa Acker-Mulder, director of the Betsy Ross House, says while there were many family tales of Betsy designing the flag, there just isn't evidence to prove it. So did she at least stitch the first flag? We can't prove that either, say experts such as Dr. Marla Miller, a colonial history professor at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst. But that doesn't mean we should ignore this historical figure.
Part of what I want people to appreciate about Betsy Ross is that she's very representative of women who lived through, arguably, the most tumultuous years in American history.
In 2010, Miller wrote Betsy Ross and the Making of America. The 480-page effort was the first scholarly biography based entirely on citable, concrete, documentary evidence of this iconic American.
She was a young woman in her 20s when revolution came. She weathered the occupation of Philadelphia with a toddler while her husband, who was a privateer, was captured at sea. He dies in an English prison.
Trained as an apprentice upholsterer, where she met her first husband, John Ross, a fellow apprentice, Betsy learned a skill that had become one of high demand as America began doing away with the Union Jack in 1777. And she had a keen sensibility for new business opportunities. Acker Mulder from the Betsy Ross House says there are receipts to support some of the old story.
We know that on May 29, 1777, Betsy Ross was paid a substantial amount of money to make a flag.
The Pennsylvania Navy Board paid for this flag and later ordered more. Invoices, ledgers, and receipts that have survived through the years tell us that Betsy Ross became a reliable maker of flags. According to Ross family lore, one day, George Washington, accompanied by two signers of the Declaration of Independence, showed up to ask her to make what is now referred to as the Betsy Ross flag. Well, that story has been tough to corroborate. Historian Marla Miller says just 2 months ago, new evidence was found proving a connection between Betsy Ross and George Washington.
The staff at Mount Vernon have recently discovered archival evidence that has George Washington buying a fully trimmed bed from John and Betsy Ross in 1774. It's very exciting.
Is it possible that the story told for centuries about Betsy Ross is true? Miller says she can't prove it, but she says we can be sure that Betsy Ross was one of the first government contractors selling goods to the new American nation. For WHYY, I'm Ryan Noyes.
Two big U.S. Supreme Court decisions are anticipated before the end of this month. Let's get a preview with Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll. Hi, Frank.
Hello, Dave.
Let's take them one at a time. First, the Affordable Care Act.
Well, we know Americans in general are still underwater when they come to perceiving the Affordable Care Act. Based on our survey and others, people have become a little more positive about it. But in terms of the entire Obamacare itself, the kind of thing that Obama was talking about this week, the president went out and talked about how it was now an integral part of our health care life here in the U.S., and how positive it was. Despite all of that, our polling and other polling still shows that at best Americans break even, but in our poll actually more negative than positive. So it's still a hard sell, even a number of years after the act was first passed. And that's kind of the context of the environment where that Supreme Court decision is going to come down into.
Though more specifically, do Americans want to see subsidies continue?
They do. A number of polls have come out recently showing that. And that's what's kind of interesting about Obamacare. When you ask about the specifics, Americans are much more positive about it than they are about the corpus of the act itself. And these polls have said if, in fact, the Supreme Court invalidates, because of the wording of the act as it was passed by Congress, the ability of these subsidies to be provided in some states, what should happen? And a majority of Americans say some other things should be done to allow these low-income people to continue to receive subsidies for their health care.
Well, now let's take up the corpus and specifics of the same-sex marriage decision.
Well, that's going to be fascinating. We've talked about this tremendous change in attitudes in general over the last 5 years, actually, to where we have a significant majority, 60% in our latest polling, saying yes, they favor same-sex marriage. We did ask more recently, is this going to be the most important thing that you take into account when you vote, whether you're for it or against it? And it's not a single issue in terms of the politics of same-sex marriage. Just about a quarter of Americans tell us that it would be something that would be vital for their vote for or against a presidential candidate. But what's interesting there, Dave, is when we interviewed on this back in 04 and 08, it was the Republicans, the conservatives, who were much more likely to say, yes, this is an issue I feel very strongly about, and a candidate needs to share my view on that. What's happened now most recently, Democrats have come to the point where they share that. So now on both sides of the issue, it's become politicized to a degree that it wasn't before. Democrats now are just as likely as Republicans to say, yes, it is an issue that will be important when I vote for a candidate.
What topics are vital for voters?
Right now, it's the economy and dysfunctional government with other concerns that are lower down on the priority list. We have an election next year. I don't know if you heard, 2016. So I went back and looked at what the priorities were for Americans, say, in 2011, 2007, 2003, the year before those elections. And what we found is things change between now and the actual election. Let me give you an example. 2007, relatively few Americans complained about the economy. They were pretty happy. Of course, by the time the 2008 election came around, we were in the middle of the Great Recession, and that was the huge issue. Same thing back in 2003. The Iraq War had begun, but it was going pretty well based on what the people said, and it was not a big issue. But by the time the 2004 election actually came around, Bush versus John Kerry, the Iraq War had risen significantly in terms of importance. All by way of saying, let's talk again next year. The issues that are concerning voters may be a lot different than they are right now.
Thanks, Frank.
You bet, Dave.
Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll. He joins us each week at this time on NewsWorks Tonight. Finally this evening, let's finish out the week with a bit of history. Philadelphia Hospitality Incorporated is leading tours through the weekend highlighting influences in Philadelphia's history. On a walking tour through Independence Mall this week, tour guide and Italian architect Francesco Scarzuti showed tour goers the Italian influence on architecture in Philadelphia. For example, he says the large back window on Independence Hall is a design by Italian Renaissance architect Andrea Palladio from the 16th century.
I think it's an important statement. In this such an important building for the history of the United States of America, I use the Palladian window. To me, this is very enlightening for how attached the history of Philadelphia is to these archetypes.
And Scarzuti suggests the use of Renaissance architecture was to intentionally relate to the Republic of Ancient Rome as a show of the strength of the new nation. Other tours, including one on Irish heritage and influence in Philadelphia, and another on the city's LGBTQ history, will take place tomorrow and Sunday, so bring your walking shoes and a sense of curiosity. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov and Kimberly Haas. We had help this week from our intern, Maggie Freeling. Our news director is Eugene Son. At the controls this week, Al Banks and Adam Staniszewski. Joyce Lieberman is our radio engineering supervisor. Our chief content officer is Christine Dempsey. Chris Cetullo is WHYY's vice president of news and civic dialogue. Thanks for joining us, and have a great weekend. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.
Delaware Valley University supports WHYY. With DelVal's Master of Arts in Counseling Psychology, students develop the skills, knowledge, and clinical experience needed to work in the lives of others. Graduates are prepared to apply for the Pennsylvania Licensed Professional Counselor credential. A specialization in social justice or child and adolescent counseling can help make a difference in the community. More about a Delaware Valley University Master of Arts in Counseling Psychology is online at delval.edu/grad.